Good evening, and welcome to the April 2018 meeting of the San Luis Obispo Health Commission. Our first order of business will be the approval of our minutes from our last meeting, March the 12th. Any additions, corrections, comments? Hearing none, we'll ask Jean to finalize them and publish them, as you always do. At this point, we will ask for any public comment. If there are persons desiring to speak on issues other than anything as is scheduled on our agenda this evening that are within the scope of interest of the Health Commission, if they would please come forward. Seeing no one stepping forward, we will start with our program this evening. So this month, we're going to hear about the medically fragile programs that we have here in San Luis Obispo County. And we have with us tonight Grace McIntosh, from CAPSLO, the Community Action Partnership of SLO County. She's going to address the 40 Prado program, as well as recuperative care. Teresa is under the weather and not with us this evening, so Grace will fill in doing both of those. So welcome, Grace.
Am I on now? Oh, I'm on now. Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much. Good evening, commissioners. My name is Grace McIntosh. I'm the deputy director at Community Action Partnership here in San Luis Obispo County. And I'm hoping to go on. There we go. Okay. So I'm going to talk a little bit, just give you an update on 40 Prado, the new homeless service center location, which is located currently across the street, sort of, to the current 43 Prado Day Center. So as you all know, now we have essentially two separate facilities. We have a day facility, which is the Prado Day Center, located on Prado Road, and then we have across town the night shelter, the Maxine Lewis Memorial Shelter. And so when 40 Prado is built, those two facilities will cease to exist. So 43 Prado will go back to the city so that they can do their much-anticipated expansion of their wastewater treatment plant, and Maxine Lewis Shelter take that property back. So what that means for our client population is they no longer will have to trek across town in the morning and in the evening to get to the facilities, because 40 Prado will be one consolidated facility. Right now, there are no kitchens at either the day or night facility. There will be a commercial kitchen at 40 Prado. The urgency, besides what I just said with the Prado Day Center being on city property, which is needed for their future water reclamation facility, but if you've ever been to the Prado Day Center or the Maxine Lewis Memorial Shelter, you will see these two facilities are well beyond their lifespan. They were not intended to be used longer than about 15 years, and it's 29. So we're eagerly awaiting this new building. So for the future, as I said, consolidated services open 24 hours a day, 100 beds, whereas now we have 50, if you include 25 to 45 of what we call our overflow beds, which are what our faith-based community has been stepping up for the last 29 years, helping us with. We've already been serving between 75 and 95 people, so 100 beds, not a huge expansion. It will include separate family dorms and the dedicated space for the recuperative care program, which I'll talk about in a couple of minutes. We will also have a full-time therapist for co-occurring disorders, and that is subcontracted through TEMA, through a grant that we have called the SLO Hub. We also have a CHC who will have two medical exam rooms there to be able to provide a patient-centered home at the facility. And then we'll have after-school activities, because right now our kids have nowhere to go, literally, because Prado closes at 4, the new center opens at 5, kids have nowhere to go after school, and so we're going to really work on having some after-school activities. One of the things that I had been asked to talk about briefly here was the proposed detox facility. We conducted a feasibility study, which was completed in December of last year. It was actually quite a lengthy and thorough discussion that involved a number of entities, city, county, hospitals, probation, just a lot of folks. And we toured some other facilities out of county. And we were able to determine that on the current footprint of 40 Prado, there was enough room potentially to build a separate building. And we worked with the city on looking at what that building might be able to accommodate. And it would be able to be 8 to 10 beds. Up there it says the ASM level of 3.1 to 3.3. There's basically levels of intensity in terms of services. Sue could probably speak to this better than I could. But essentially, this is considered to be a fairly lower level. It is a medically based withdrawal treatment facility. However, it is not intense, so it is not a 24-hour medical component attached to a hospital setting. So this would be more than likely people that we're already serving. These would be adult clients that would be placed by county drug and alcohol, so these would be county residents only. We would construct the facility, but the operations would be conducted through a request for proposals from county drug and alcohol services. So they would not operate it, but they would submit a request for proposals out into the community. The operating costs is something that really, it's kind of been amazing because up until the ACA, the operational costs were really one of the primary factors, that and just where would we actually put this facility. But with ACA, we were able to now look at drug Medi-Cal reimbursements, or the county is able to look at drug Medi-Cal reimbursements. In addition, for that small match that is required for drug Medi-Cal, they're looking at really the savings, primarily for probation, around out-of-county placements, which right now, if someone is mandated to go into a facility, probation actually has to drive them to wherever. And the nearest place now is Fresno, Los Angeles. There was a facility in Ventura, but that was severely damaged, if not altogether eliminated, by the fire, the Thomas fire. So the timeline for that is right now we're beginning discussions, serious discussions now with the city around the permitting process, about answering any further questions they have, and then securing county approval. I believe that the county staff is going before the Board of Supervisors, I believe, on July 10th to discuss further the operational planning of it, including budget, and then the selection of the operator licensure. As I said, county drug and alcohol would secure the license with the state, but then they would then do a request for proposals and then setting up the contract. So it's approximately a 22 to 24 month, but we're really hoping to fast track that as soon as possible because there is simply no disagreement that this is something we desperately need. Any questions on the detox? I know I'm probably whipping through this, but yes, Susan.
Yeah, I just had one question when you were talking about who'd be admitted. Will the ERs be able to send people over?
They would have to have ensured that these were already open to county drug and alcohol. So probably what we would be looking at is if appropriate, right now the recuperative care program, which I'm going to talk about next, accepts patients directly from the hospital setting. What we're seeing is many of those patients currently have co-occurring disorder or at the least substance use disorder. So we would look at that, but that's certainly a discussion that I know the county and the hospitals would like to have, is to somehow kind of make that a little more seamless. Okay, all right. So the recuperative care program. So this is a program that is in partnership with SenCal, and unfortunately Teresa was not able to make it today. She's not feeling great. the concept. So this really started really with some discussions that Teresa and I were having about 4 years ago about a need that was being seen increasingly in the hospitals. But these were patients that were being discharged from the hospital or ER. They were homeless. They didn't really have anywhere to go, but they needed to be discharged, but they were still fragile. So they would get discharged essentially to the street. We saw many of them at Prado Day Center, but they really weren't appropriate. They really needed a place to recuperate, to rest. And there is no day bed in the entire county at this point. Echo is an overnight shelter only, and Maxine, up until this point, was only open at night. So the only place they could really go would be the Prado Day Center, but it's certainly not appropriate for someone who's recuperating from a hospital stay. It was based on the Boston Healthcare for the Homeless, which is an excellent, excellent program, a best practice, and it's really around the whole person model of care. We started back in 2016. We opened up our Maxine Lewis Memorial Shelter for 6 beds. So it is still essentially not open during the day, but for these 6 individuals. When we were looking to start the program, we talked quite a bit with hospital administration, other individuals, SenCal certainly, case managers, and that really the 2 primary factors to readmission is the lack of the reliable and timely transport. For appointments. So right now you get out of the hospital, you oftentimes will need to make an appointment with your primary care as a follow-up. So navigating that system, getting there, if you're homeless, if you're fragile, it was a problem. They had a high number of appointments that were missed, that were canceled, that were simply never made. And then again, the lack of assistance in understanding and navigating that system. And this was really quite the eye-opener for us as we started doing it ourselves, especially the again, the seamlessness between discharge, pharmacy, primary care, and specialty care. If it's challenging for us, imagine how it is if you are homeless and fragile and have no transportation and maybe don't even have anyone to help you. So our services essentially are 24-hour supervision. So in the evening, of course, we become the shelter again. And so they have the meals and the bed and the shower. But this is now during the day. They have access to that. We do transport them to their appointments. We transport them to the pharmacy. And that is really, really essential because as we were finding, the pharmacy was the first place where we started to see problems. And I'll talk about that in a minute. We do have a part-time nurse on site. She is a capsule staff person who has been really essential in working with home health, but also making sure that the patient really understands the medications that he or she is taking, the appropriate dosages, ensuring that they're complying with the discharge plan and then with the primary care follow-up orders, and advocating for specialty care especially because so many of our patients need specialty care. We have a case manager, a full-time case manager at the 1 to 6. When we move into 40 Prado, that will go to 9. We'll expand to 9 patients. And that individual coordinates all of the post-discharge planning services with the hospital. They identify additional supports that that patient may need. Again, looking beyond just the primary reason why you have come to us, maybe the procedure that you had or the accident or injury that you sustained, but more so now looking at, so what's next? What were some of the underlying reasons that caused you to eventually be in the hospital? Where do we go from here so that you don't end up back in the hospital? Referrals to the full case management program at Capslo, going back into our general population. One of the things that we found is amazingly, we've housed a number of these folks directly from the program. And then really, really using volunteer support. That has been a significant component of this program, really looking at everything from spiritual care to nutritional volunteering to people who just want to come and walk with them. Volunteer support has been instrumental. So the first day in the life of an RCP patient, and I talk about this because really the first 6 months, and even to a certain extent, it's still happening. We're still learning as we go the system and just continue to sort of shake our heads and wonder how on earth these poor people would do this on their own. So usually what will happen, and fortunately it still happens more than we like, is we'll get a contact around 1 o'clock in the afternoon from the hospital, and they have a discharge that day. They need to get them out by Friday. They can't be here for the weekend, so I need you to come and get them. In the best case scenario, our nurse who does work on Friday and our case manager will go to the hospital, and they will interview the patient at the hospital with the social worker or the hospital RN present. That's the best case scenario. The worst case is just the case manager goes, or even worse, they call me and we do a telephone kind of consultation. But in the best case scenario, which is the majority of times, the nurse will review the discharge orders right then. One of the things we had to do is we learned the hard way is we do not now leave the hospital with that patient until we have verified that the medications are in fact over at the pharmacy, they are in fact ready to be picked up, and they are in fact being covered by SoCal Health. Because that did not happen a lot of the time, and we had some pretty scary issues. Because we found out that, again, that 7-prescription max, oftentimes our patients came from the creek. Their meds are at the creek. They're gone. Well, if they've hit that 7-prescription max, or if it's they're asking to fill it prior to 30 days, that's not going to happen without an override. So we've learned how to do that. We've learned how to advocate, and we've learned how to teach our patients how to do that, how to contact SoCal Health and get that. But what if that's after 5 p.m.? It's not happening. So that is another reason why we would not initially take any patients after 5 p.m. or on the weekends, because that simply wouldn't happen. One case, and this is true, we had a patient who was an insulin-dependent diabetic, and we went to a local pharmacy here on a Friday night and were told they did not have any insulin. So lots of concerns, lots of issues that we have hammered out during the first 6 to 8 months. Do they still happen? Yes, but we're able to kind of get a little bit more proactive about it instead of reactive. So that would happen. We would then take the patient to pick up the prescriptions, clear up any continuing issues. Sometimes we'd have to pay to get the meds ourselves, and that's fine. That's what we'll do that. But again, can our patients sometimes do that? The $125? No. So oftentimes they would just go without and then end up right back in the ER. We then will take the patient to the shelter. The nurse would complete the med sheet, provide the staff with the information, sit down with the patient, go over the meds, make sure he or she understands what they need to do. And then this was the other aha thing, was we begin the process of what we call weaning that patient off the emergency department or ER dependency during the next 7 to 10 days. One of the things we found out in the beginning of the program was that quite often our patients would get anxious, or they would feel as though, I have to go to the ER. I'm sick, I'm this, I'm that, I'm whatever. I got to go to the ER. Well, we're not going to deny them that. So we would take them to the ER. And 99% of the time, it was not really an ER necessary issue. They had become so used to going to the ER as their primary care, that when they were anxious or when they were feeling like they needed to go, they would just go. And so over the course of the first 2 weeks, we began to, if we really felt that this was really more an anxiety issue or in some cases seeking drug issue, we would begin to talk with that individual. We would begin to educate him or her. And what we found was that if the patient stays with us long enough, that dependency of, I just want to go to the ER, especially coupled with then the increase in the primary care connection and the specialty care connection, they began to then transfer that need over to the more appropriate primary care physician. So it was really, really, it's been a really interesting process. So the results, and this is the first year. And really, the first 3 months of the year, we really only had one or two patients. So we had 17 patients up until then. We've had about 65. The average stay was 53 bed nights, and that is considered a best practice at this point. That was not what was originally wanted by the hospitals. They thought a week, 14 days. And we kept saying, you know, you can do a week or 14 days, and then that patient will be right back in the hospital. We've got to start peeling the onion layers. And so that is considered a best practice, those nights. We had two what SenCal called outliers, one of whom is pictured there. That gentleman actually had a terminal diagnosis when he came to us. He was terminal. He had metastasized lung, brain, and kidney cancer. He was actually in the Tribune, and so we have lots of authorizations to talk about him. So, because he's really a miracle story. And so we were able to connect him with the oncologist here in town, Dr. Spillane. And Dr. Spillane said, you know, I'm going to try this guy on a new drug at the time, Keytruda. And he is now in remission. It has been so phenomenal, this drug, for Anthony, that he is now living a much better life and actually toured the Weinman Hotel. Still can't quite do those stairs, but we were able to secure him a voucher, and he's going to get into housing. He would be, Dr. Spillane said, he would be dead if it weren't for this program, because we advocated to get him the treatment he needed. So he's been with us a long time, so he's an outlier in terms of those numbers. The other individual had chronic conditions that would have placed him in a skilled nursing facility for the rest of his life. He is now housed at the Weinman and doing well. So it is a preventive and it is a low-cost alternative to the long-term care that these two gentlemen absolutely would have been in. So results, because we all have to look at, obviously, in addition to the incredible patient results, is this financially a feasible program? And the answer is absolutely yes. So SenCal ran numbers on patient bed days. Prior to RCP, those 17 individuals had cost SenCal about $336,000. Post-RCP, for a 30 and 60-day period, depending on when they first came in, cost was down to $99,000. So it is saving in terms of bed days. People do come. They learn what they can do to advocate for themselves, to help themselves. We hook them up. And the idea is that they don't go back in to the hospital. And that seems to be where we're at. Any questions?
Questions from anyone?
So I have one, and then the rest of you chime in. So the number of patients that you serve, I'm sure there are more patients that need to be served. Are we looking at being able to do that in the near future, or how much are we going to stay within the realm of the program here? What needs to happen in order for you to do more to serve more patients?
Well, we are going from 6 to 9 in the new facility. It's funding, primarily. We're really at what I consider to be pretty bare bones at this point, and anticipating the type of patient that we will be getting, because we're talking with the hospitals. There are certain patients we really are not comfortable having now because of the condition of the shelter. But when we move, we will be looking at taking patients, for example, that have PICC lines. So right now, I'm concerned about the staff capacity. So that's really the reason. If we had more funding, we could have more staff and increase the number.
And are you taking patients from all of our hospitals, North County as well as South County?
Yes, although the majority is from French and Sierra Vista. Okay.
Yes. What are your numbers as compared to Transitions Food and Shelter up in the North County, who handle many of the folks from Twin?
You know, I don't know. I haven't had actually a discussion with Kevin for months. Their program is a little different in terms of, you know, they have the apartments and the motels, and then they have, I don't know exactly how many hours a week Kevin works. I don't know if he's full-time now.
I think he's full-time now.
The other Kevin. But it is different, where a lot of their time they are alone and they're not monitored. And so whereas our patients are monitored 24/7, and so I know that for some patients, they don't need that. And ideally, those would be the ones that go to transitional food and shelter. But I know that there are patients that do need a higher level of just monitoring, making sure that no one else is coming, and potentially harming them. So I don't know offhand what TFS's numbers are. I know they have a lot more bed options than we do.
Right, and they usually keep them pretty full.
They do.
Yeah.
There's certainly a need. I mean, there's a need in South County. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. Two other questions in regard to the new shelter. When you mentioned that CHC is going to have literally some exam rooms there and be there, is that only open to the homeless that are residents or staying there? Or would other homeless people be able to access those CHC services at the shelter?
I think the ideal is that it becomes a patient-centered home, so anyone would be able to come in. We have to be careful in terms of security, so anyone that comes onto our site has to have some paperwork done. But again, I think with 125-plus people, I think they're going to be pretty full.
Right. It just seems like it would be a nice draw to introduce some of the other people to the site and what's there to be offered.
Mm-hmm.
My other question is I've heard something about drug and alcohol and maybe mental health services. Those are going to be offered on site so that your folks don't have to travel across town to go to drug and alcohol or mental health?
Well, we will be working with Community Counseling Center for the mild to moderate.
Good.
For individuals who need to have an open mental health case, they will still have to go to county mental health. And I believe the same for county drug and alcohol. They will not be coming to us. TEMA, we are contracting with TEMA for the integrated treatment program that we have there for up to 30 clients. And that is a new SAMHSA grant that we were able to get. So they will be on site 40 hours.
My concern is just the transportation, because much of drug and alcohol stuff is at night, and so usually in a shelter you want to have everybody in at night. So I hope they'll work with you.
What we do currently now, if somebody's working and we know what their schedule is, we're fine with that. If they are going to a class, or even now at Maxine, if they're going across the street to the Ilano Club for a meeting, they let us know, and then we're okay. Ideally, we will continue to have AANA meetings on site. I would love to have county drug and alcohol on site, and I would love to have county mental health on site. Anyone who wants to come and provide a service to our clients, we welcome.
Good. Thank you.
Can you go back one slide to the financial part?
I hope I can.
I've managed to. Oh, there it is. Great.
Oh, maybe
no, it's.
Can do
it. I think it's the next one down, number 12. Yeah. I'm just curious. These cost comparisons. Who's paying those?
SoCal Health.
Okay.
They are the Medi-Cal provider.
And so is it all out-of-county financial support then?
SoCal Health is SLO County's Medi-Cal, so managed care provider. And I don't know provider. Penny, help me out here. So they manage all of the Medi-Cal recipients, of which the majority of our clients are. And so they receive funding from the federal government, Medicaid. Medi-Cal is the California version of Medicaid.
Sure.
And so those funds then go to support the hospital stays and subsequent primary care. That is all managed through SoCal Health. I don't know if I answered your question.
Well, I'm embarrassed to be so poorly informed about it, frankly. You mentioned a 7 prescription max at some point. What is that?
SoCal Health has a maximum number that is capped in terms of in any given 30-day period or at any given time that a patient can have no more than 7 prescription medications that are covered through SoCal Health unless you go and request a waiver for that. And there's usually a rationale, so a doctor's authorization or something like that. So it's a SoCal, and I don't know, again, I'm going to look at Penny. Do you know if there's any kind of federal requirement around that or yeah, it may just be a SoCal. If Teresa were here, she would have the answer in a minute.
Well, thanks. I'd just like to applaud your effort and commitment. It's so impressive to sit here and listen to this.
Thank you. We're trying. Appreciate it.
But, just to clarify, as so far as a provider serving 60% of my patients are SoCal patients, and many of them do have more than 7 meds, none of them really, we just never not prescribe because of that limitation. It's always been covered. So,
It's just another kind of bureaucratic step that a lot of times our clients wouldn't even begin to know how to navigate. So that's one of the things we teach them, how to do that. Because you're right, it is very common. Thank you.
Thank you, Grace. So now we're going to welcome Laurel Weir, who's the Community Relations and Program Development Manager. And you're going to talk about the 50 Now program, right?
Yes, and I don't have slides, so I'm just going to talk. So good evening, everyone. I'm Laurel Weir, and I'm from the Department of Social Services, and I staff the county's Homeless Services Oversight Council. And I'm going to be talking today about the county's 50 Now program, which is a housing first program for chronically homeless people. The program came about in 2014, and it was the result of us kind of thinking about folks who are chronically homeless and what could we do to assist them and to do something about chronic homelessness, and particularly the folks who are very vulnerable. Research that has been done and actually was done in part and then compiled in part by Dr. Jim O'Connell from Boston Healthcare for the Homeless Program that Grace mentioned, shows that homeless people who are chronically homeless die on average about 20 years earlier than than a housed American low-income person. He has done some research, or rather in Boston, Jim O'Connell led some research on what are the risk factors of dying among folks who are homeless. He became interested in this because he has this photo that he has of about 10 or so people that he took at one point. And 5 years later, it was sitting on his desk. He was looking at it, and all but one of the people in the photo were dead. And he said, but they were only in their 60s, and they looked healthy, so why did they die? So they did a retrospective look back. They partnered with the city, and I think this might have been pre-HIPAA, but they looked at hospital records and healthcare for the homeless records and looked back over multiple years and came up with 8 factors, independent risk factors, that were associated with an increased risk of dying. And so those factors were that, and these are among chronic homeless people. So first of all, having trimorbidity. So someone who has a co-occurring mental illness, addictions disorder, and a co-occurring chronic health condition. Having end-stage renal disease, liver failure, or in the kind of last stages of that. Being HIV positive or having AIDS. Simply being age 60 or older. And this next item will show where the research was done. Having a prior experience of hypothermia or immersion foot, because this, of course, was done in Boston. So we see a little more hypothermia cases there than we would here. But having been on the streets, immersion foot, which we do see here, is also a risk factor. In addition, having been to the hospital emergency room more than 3 times in the past 6 months, or having been hospitalized more than 3 times in the past year. And so any one of those factors is predictive of an increased risk of dying. those factors have now been turned into a tool called the Vulnerability Index. And you can do this survey and identify whether or not folks have this risk factor. So a number of communities a few years back started participating in something called the 100,000 Homes Campaign. And this was a program that encouraged communities to adopt Housing First programs for chronically homeless people and use the Vulnerability Index to prioritize people for that housing. And so we joined that campaign in 2013 and started working on a proposal that we brought to the board to create such a program here, and the board approved that. And in 2014, we got the final approval and funding for that. And we partnered with the Housing Authority of San Luis Obispo. The county provides funding for services as well as security deposits and some what I would call landlord mitigation funds and moving in expenses. The Housing Authority has offered us 50 housing choice vouchers so that we could put people into housing and then the county would pay for the services to keep people in that housing. And we contracted with Transitions Mental Health Association to operate the program. And we began operating in 2014. And we did it as a pilot, 3-year pilot program. And we said to the board that we would house at least 50 people, that they would stay housed, at least 60% would stay housed for at least 6 months. And these are folks who, of course, have been on the streets in some cases for 10 or 20 years. We also said to the board that we would reduce the number of days in jail by 50%, as well as arrest. And we would reduce the decrease the number of ER visits by 50% and a 50% reduction in the days at the psychiatric health facility. And so at the 3-year mark, we came back to the board and did a presentation. With the help of SanCal Health and the clients' release of information forms, we were able to actually track for those clients their use of not only the ERs, but the hospitals, and they're also their primary care visits as well. And so what we found was, first of all, we exceeded the number of our target number for reduction in ER visits. We hit, it was 51.7% decrease in ER visits. And the number of ER visits that did occur after people were housed, because we tracked 1 year before housing and 1 year after housing. And the folks who did go to the ER, we did find that they were what they call good ER visits, that they were for reasons that you would want someone to go to an ER. And they had reduced their use of the ER for things that could have been served at either urgent care or at a primary care physician visit. They also reduced the number of days in the psychiatric health facility. Oh, and by the way, SanCal also found that the number of primary care physician visits went up. So they shifted their resources or their use of services away from the emergency services over to primary care. We also found that they decreased the number of psychiatric health facility bed days by 69.2%, so just under 70% reduction in psychiatric health facility bed days. We had a 97.8% reduction in jail days and a 96% reduction in arrests. And actually, the only folks who actually ended up being arrested were two folks who had a prior outstanding warrant. And so they arranged for them to be arrested so that they could go before a court and have most of the charges dismissed and or rather kind of kept on hold. And the judge kept one charge there and said that he would waive that or discharge it after they had been in the program for another year. So they weren't fresh arrests, but they were taking care of old arrests. So we've been very pleased with the program. And the board last year voted to continue the program. The Homeless Services Oversight Council is considering this week, actually, recommendations to the board to expand the program. So the preliminary recommendation that was made at the full HSOC meeting was to expand it by 10 slots each year for the next 3 years. And the full executive committee will vote on that on Wednesday. So I wanted to just say something else briefly about the model that we use. It's Housing First. It's everyone here familiar with the Housing First model? Yes. Okay. So it is something that we didn't have in this county before that we really wanted to try. And this was part of the proposal to the board was we said, yes, let us put people into housing and tell them you can drink as much as you want. And let's see if we can actually reduce their drinking and make them healthier. And so it's kind of one of the strange things about the program, which is when you put people into housing, it makes a lot of changes in people, and it is treatment in a certain extent. It does not stop everyone from drinking. It does not necessarily reduce in everyone. We do have a few folks who have cycled out. We do think of the program as not if you're out, you're out. But if it doesn't work the first time, we will try to look at and see if there's another housing opportunity for them at a later point that may fit better with them. Because one of the things that we know from the research about chronically homeless people is that the solutions for each person are very individualized. And so you really have to make the situation work for them. So TEMA uses a lot of congregate housing. The research suggests that people who are chronically homeless do better actually in congregate housing. And so, but sometimes when you're living with one group of folks, that may not gel so well. And so sometimes moving them to a different situation can work. And so being flexible and knowing that you may have to look at different options in order to succeed. But knowing that that people need to have more than one chance in order to succeed. So that's been an important philosophy in that program. And we are now integrating the process for prioritizing people for that program in with some of our other housing programs. We have a federally funded program called the Continuum of Care Permanent Supportive Housing Program. That's also a Housing First model. It has a less service intensity than 50 Now. 50 Now uses an ACT team, the sort of community treatment team. So in their case, they have a nurse, they have a mental health therapist, and they have a peer support counselor who provide support on the drug and alcohol side. The Continuum of Care Permanent Supportive Housing Program has a single case manager, so it's a little less service intensive, but still intended for people who are chronically homeless. And we use this vulnerability index combined with another tool called the SPDAT, or Services Prioritization Decision Assistance Tool. Together it's the VI SPDAT, and we use that to prioritize people for the different kinds of housing based on their level of need. The county also recently got funding for a new program called the Housing and Disability Advocacy Program, and we are partnering that with 50 Now to serve a few additional folks as well. So we're gradually trying to integrate the various housing programs. We're also, through the what's called a coordinated entry process, working with the different homeless services agencies around the county, and particularly the ones that are the primary coordinated entry agencies, which are CAPSLO's shelter, the Echo Shelter, and Five Cities Homeless Coalition, and the Prado Day Center. They are surveying folks who are chronically homeless with the VI SPDAT, and then we are combining that, and we're just putting everybody's scores together based on their VI SPDAT score and the length of time that they've been homeless, and then we're prioritizing people for housing as it comes up. We've also been gradually reaching out to partner agencies, so some of the hospitals are now beginning to do some VI SPDATs. Some of the social workers are doing VI SPDATs on some of their chronically homeless clients. The Morro Bay Community Resource Center has also been serving folks. TEMA's homeless outreach team has been serving folks. So we're gradually teaching folks how to use this tool and adding into the core group of people who are doing the surveying so that we can reach more and more people, including some of the folks who are not necessarily coming into some of the service agencies. So we're really excited about the chance to reach more people. We still, unfortunately, have fewer slots than the number of people who need them. But we are trying to use those slots as best we can by doing this triaging process to try to really prioritize the folks who have the highest needs. So because we have this scarce resource, we want to try to match it as best we can and not have it be simply who, you know, first come, first serve, or who just happened to show up on the right day. So we're trying to use them as best we can. And so that's something that we're moving forward on. And I anticipate reaching out to more community groups over time and would love to talk with you all further about that as we move forward with that process. So, yes.
Currently, where do you get most of your referrals?
It's kind of comes from different places. We just got done updating the monthly list today. So it's a combination of the various homeless service agencies along with the homeless outreach team. We get quite a number from that. And we also get them from hospitals and from the Morro Bay Community Resource Center has been very busy. We also are starting to get a few from the warming centers as well. And then we partner sometimes with folks. We do have at least one trained volunteer who is sometimes available to go out. We've gotten calls before from local police departments about people that they're concerned about. And so sometimes we've been able to have the volunteer go out and actually survey people on the street. So, it's a mixture of the different groups, but certainly homeless outreach team is a big player in that.
Any other questions?
Yes.
I think you touched on this a little bit, but I'm wondering what the most common or common reasons that folks leave your program. And
it's a mixture. So one is the tool, unfortunately, does do a good job of predicting who has a better risk of dying. So we have had some folks come in who, one of the first things that TEMA will do is they'll have the nurse working with the client to kind of assess their health needs. And that's part of how they build the relationship with the client is, you know, getting them care for the different issues that have been concerning them. But unfortunately, sometimes what we find is that it turns out that they have a terminal illness. And so some of the folks have, quite a number actually have passed away. The other issue I would say, addictions disorders. So that is probably the tougher issue of the different issues and the trimorbidity apart from somebody passing away.
Right. If you had unlimited resources, what would you want to do?
Expand that program pretty dramatically.
What's your ideal? How many do you think?
We've been talking about it in the HSOC a little bit, and I think that we probably, the information that we have suggests that they're probably just shy of around 400 chronically homeless folks in a given year and individuals, and then probably at least another 60 to 70 homeless families with children mm-hmm. who are chronically homeless. And so housing for those folks would be supportive housing with the level of service that's appropriate to their needs. So either the ACT team or case manager, depending on what they're able to succeed with.
It's an awesome philosophy. Thank you for that wonderful program. It's great.
If someone out there, because I know there's a lot of volunteers in all of our communities, and some of them are doing little things here and there for the mm-hmm. homeless that are there, but if they wanted someone to get in touch with this program, mm-hmm. Who would we refer them to?
Well, the main thing is the only way to get into the program is to have the VISPADAT done. So, any of the coordinated entry sites can do that. The homeless outreach team also does quite a number of them. And, you know, if there's a community organization, like we train someone at the Community Resource Center to do that, we can train folks. It's got good inter-rater reliability, so it's something that's fairly easy to train. We do typically prefer to have people doing it who either have experience working with folks who are homeless or experience working with folks with mental illness or drug and alcohol addictions disorders. So, but if there's somebody out there that's already working with folks on a regular basis, we'd be happy to come in and train. And then it's just a matter of that group getting that VI-SPDAT to us and for us to score it.
I know a few months ago we had one of the people from homeless service people come on out and talk about hepatitis C, hepatitis C, case managing it and whatnot. Good news, we now have a nurse practitioner who's actually specialized in GI, and she treats hepatitis C.
Nice.
So previously the patient would come and we diagnose and they had to be sent out somewhere and transportation was a huge issue, as well as someone taking them there, right? Yes. The case managing it. So now, since this nurse practitioner, Teresa Mayers, she just joined us, and she is based out of Nipomo Clinic.
Okay.
She's there 3 days full-time in Nipomo, and CHC does provide a transportation, so that's not an issue. So as long as that we can diagnose them, they come in and do preventive care, which that's a challenge of homeless population, then we can just send the patient to Teresa, and Teresa can treat the patient as long as the patient does not have a advanced stage of a hepatitis C, which means a liver damage.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
All right. Well, thank you for coming. We hope you'll come back and keep us updated with what's going on with it. Good luck with expanding it. I think we all think that that's important. And if there's something that we could do as a health commission to help you support that or whatever, we certainly would be happy to do that. Well, did you have another question, Susan?
Yes.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you would mention again the May meeting and what maybe the audience or any of the commissioners might support that.
So the meeting that Sue's referencing, the Board of Supervisors has asked the Homeless Services Oversight Council to bring some recommendations to them about what kind of housing is needed and where to address homelessness, and as well as some case management recommendations. And so the Executive Committee is meeting this week to finalize that, and then that's going to be brought before the board in early May at the board meeting, the first board meeting in May, and the date I think is the 4th or 5th. It's that first Tuesday in May.
First.
Is it first? Okay.
The 1st of May is the first
Tuesday. All right. Thank you, Sue. So once those recommendations are finalized, you know, if it's something that folks want to support, then they can come to the board meeting. Or if they don't want to support, they can still come to the board meeting either way and weigh in on their thoughts on those recommendations.
Okay. Thank you for coming this evening.
All right. Thank you. Okay.
So we'll ask Dr. Bornstein for our public health report for this month.
Sure, thank you. This is really exciting stuff. I'm peripherally involved, and it's just been great to watch the development of all of these programs and how they're working together. So Slow Hub and 50 Now and behavioral and primary care integration, lots of good things happening in our community. So with that, I'll talk about some specific things, though, from the public health end. So last week was National Public Health Week, and I just want to let you know that a number of our staff were out in force, particularly at the farmers market, and had just a really high number of interested people, because we weren't just handing out brochures. We were doing interactive, you know, testing and games and exercise and a bunch of different things that really seemed to get the community's interest. And it so happens that this is the 100th anniversary of the Spanish flu, one of the biggest killers And so it's 100 years later, a great opportunity to say we've made a lot of progress in what kills us. We do all die still, and so we die of different things. But for the most part, public health, one of the greatest successes of the last century, has really been in the communicable disease arena. So anyway, I just thought I would mention that in the context of National Public Health Week in some areas where we've made a lot of progress. I'm sure that those of you who, probably most of you who had the flu this year didn't feel that way, but we really, as a society, are doing a whole lot better.
We all had flu shots and none of us got the flu, yeah. Right?
We also, this week, we started our annual seasonal mosquito surveillance. So we will be, once again, keeping an eye on what types of mosquitoes we're finding in our community and hoping to continue to stave off the newest variety that is being spread in California and other parts of the country, the Aedes species, which is the carrier of Zika and a number of other things, including yellow fever, dengue, et cetera. But we have there was a lot of discussion at the board level, finances being what they are. We're not moving forward at this time with a broader mosquito control program, but we do still have the opportunity to at least keep our eyes on the mosquito species and do some widespread surveillance. So that's a good thing. In keeping with the kind of work that you heard, I'm very excited that after a long period of vacancy, I know that I had introduced our nurse, Laura Jameson, but what's nice about having her in our MISP program now, Medically Indigent Services Program, is we're really trying to get the word out that beyond being able to enroll just a very few small number of people in that program is really sort of getting her out on the road to make that service known, that she can now help navigate people to whatever source of care that is available to them, be it Medi-Cal, be it behavioral health, be it Covered California, finding a provider, et cetera. So I'm just going to take the opportunity again to sort of talk about that expanded role of having a public health nurse as a health navigator, and the way to reach her is 781-4838. So that is our medical health, our healthcare navigation services. They are also, that program, in the process of updating a database that's been in place since, I think, the early 80s. It's a really old system. So we're finally, they are the last ones to come onto our electronic health care records system. We had done all the public health clinics, so reproductive health and immunizations and TB, and then we did the jail. And so the last phase of this is our MISP program is going to be coming online with our EHR system. So that's a good thing, because we always worry about the one person who's long since retired, who's the only one who knows the exact existing database. So we're going to cross that finish line before he moves out of state or worse. So a whole lot of us from the county just spent 4 days at Camp San Luis at a specialized training for emergency management, and that was a really good opportunity for all of the key players from all the county agencies, both internal to the county as well as external partners, to do a pretty extensive exercise on an earthquake. It was the emergency of choice for this particular training exercise. It was coincidental, I just learned a couple of days ago that at the time that we were literally getting under our desks and they were doing a simulated shaking of the room, there was an actual 5.8 earthquake going on at in the Channel Islands. So I don't mean to be glib about it, but obviously there's a reason for us to be doing these kinds of trainings. So but that was a really good experience for I don't know, there had to be about 50 people from our county as part of that. So two other announcements. One is a high five to our WIC staff. We always have state auditors who come on an annual basis to look at how we're doing our services and our database and data collection and services provided. And it's pretty much unheard of that they leave without at least one thing that they're able to find that someone didn't cross a T or dot an I or worse. But we're very excited that they actually could find findings in our audit. So that was really amazing. We have a wonderful WIC team. For those of you who don't know, WIC, Women, Infants, and Children, is a supplemental nutrition program from the USDA that is funded through the state to provide pregnant women, postpartum women, infants, and children up to the age of 5 with supplemental nutrition. And we also do quite a bit of breastfeeding support. And while Kathleen Carley, who's our health promotion director, was sitting in my office today waiting for me, running late from something else, happened to be reading the 1997. She found herself sitting next to all of our annual reports back in the day. And in 1997, apparently, our community's breastfeeding rate was 37%. So we've come a long way, and a good bit of that is due to our hospitals, but also our WIC program. So that's timely news. And the last thing I wanted to announce is we've been working with the Air Pollution Control District. I think someone had asked the question, one of our public speakers, about how come, you know, we're not doing as much in the way of education. And we actually took that sentiment back and got together with Air Pollution Control District and refreshed all of our educational material that we had produced in 2012. So we have three different brochures that are now out related to cardiac and respiratory illness related to air pollution. It's sort of generic. It's not specific to particulate matter or any geographic area, but we are universally in the process of getting those documents into providers' offices, into community settings, and any place, you know, really trying to do a wide distribution throughout the community on ways that people can deal with exposures and avoid exposures and keep themselves healthier in the face of air pollution. So that is my report.
Any question from commissioners?
Have we heard anything more about the training that we all did and the follow-up from the committees?
In our community health improvement
yes.
planning process? Slow health
yes.
Council? Yeah. Yeah. So we were hoping to get at least a first draft out before our accreditation coordinator went out on maternity leave. That happened last week, and I'm not using her as our lone excuse, but it's going to be a little bit slower than we had intended. We got all of the groups, but for one, have produced pretty much a final version of the measures and objectives that we're going to be looking at over the initial period. And so some of the groups did get back together 2-3 times and really flesh that out. Not all of them did. We hope within weeks rather than months with some backup staff to get a draft version out to all of the participants as well as other, you know, key players, and to use that as our first chip. And we did get what I have been saying to anyone who wants to hear. We recognize that we put an awful lot on the participants in a relatively short period of time, and so we're treating this very much as our starting point, not our ending point, and hope that we can bring the group back together at least on an annual basis and really build from there. But yes, so the short answer to your question would be we hope within several weeks to have a draft available.
Have each of us, as individuals in the groups that we were, have you all heard from your leadership team? I know we got ours, the Access to Care, last week or so. And it looked like pretty much they all had a draft on the Google
yeah.
thing.
Yeah, and I think Sue's question is because I think that's the one group that's still struggling to pull
together. Yeah, because I haven't heard anything.
I've been looking for the rest of you.
The ones that was a little sketchy, yeah, but they were working at it.
Oh. Okay, so yeah, we're gonna have to do a little bit of nudging, but I think we've made a lot of progress. So thanks for asking.
Yeah, I'll nudge Frank too.
Actually, the objectives all looked really. I just thumbed through them. They all looked really good. Very. I mean, some of them were really aggressive. I hope we can do all of that. So.
Well, you bring, 97 visionaries into a room. And
yeah,
and, what a task. And the thing that we recognized that the data was not as prominent in the working groups as we had thought we were communicating. And so some of the work afterwards was trying to make a nexus between what are the most important things that we saw in the CHA, the needs assessment, and these various databases, and the energy and the thoughts that came out of the group. And so we've really worked hard to try to find the right balance between, what are the sort of health indicators that jump off the page as being worse in our county than other places, and meld that with some of the just passionate energy that was rising up over the course of the day.
Well, it's a great start, without a doubt.
All right, shall we have commissioner updates? Bob, I know you have something to report. Let's start down at your end.
Well, getting back to the air pollution issue, as far as the Nipomo Mesa air pollution problem, we may be moving toward an actual resolution, or at least a reasonable hope that there'll be a resolution in the next few years. It's been a long process. You know, just to recap it, the air pollution control officer filed a notice of violation against state parks, which led to a sort of a quasi-judicial hearing before the hearing board for the APCD. And the point of this, and Penny, help me if I've got some of this incorrect, the point of going before the hearing board would be to finally decide if there had actually been a violation of a number of state regulations about basically public health nuisances. So it started out as kind of a trial, and in between dates, the air pollution control officer and the state parks representative got together and produced a proposed stipulated agreement on how to resolve this. It turned out this was a really weak document, and the hearing board was not supportive of it at all. They wanted defined outcomes. They wanted specific remedies. They wanted a minimum of continued negotiation over what was a reasonable standard. And so they sent the two participants back to try to present another agreement with, I think, some very stringent requests on their part. They directed the APCO and the state park representative to come back with an agreement that would reduce the air pollution, the particulate pollution on the Nipomo Mesa, by 50%, which, as I look at the numbers, that would get the CDF zone, for instance, on the Mesa at the same level about as people in San Luis Obispo in the city experience, which is it would be a remarkable outcome. And I think the hearing board is very serious about this. They're all professionals. They're non-political. So we'll see what comes. The next meeting is in this room Monday morning, April 30th. And I'd be watching the paper over the next few weeks for a new proposal from the two sides. And maybe one more thing on that. State Parks, as I understand it, is pretty motivated to come to an agreement, because if they don't, they're likely to receive a formal finding of violation, which has a number of negative impacts for them, including making them more vulnerable to some of the lawsuits that have been filed, for instance. And maybe even, this sounds like a dream, but maybe having the county remove the, the LeGrande tract, which is a major part of the riding area and a large part of the off-highway vehicle area is actually owned by the county and somehow leased to the state. So state parks should be motivated. It'll be interesting to see. April 30th.
Thanks for keeping us up to date on that. Jean?
A few weeks ago, I went to Slo County Health and Fitness Expo. And surprisingly, a lot of good news. We talked about a few months ago having a residential program for substance abuse treatment. And I found out we do have one here. It's called Heaven at Tismo Beach. Mm-hmm. They do not accept the public insurance. They've been in business for about a year. They will take an adolescent. So we don't have to ship our adolescents to LA or other areas. But they'll take every private insurance that's out there, except SanCal and Medicare at the moment. So, but that's a good option. It's a residence program for adolescents as well as adults, both male and female.
They advertise on TV quite a bit, or I've seen it. Okay. Jean?
No report.
Susan?
Yes, Laurel pretty much gave our report on what's coming up. That's what the HSOC has really been working on the last few months, is to putting those recommendations together for the soups. And it's just exciting that our supervisors are prioritizing the homelessness and those needs at the level that they are. So I encourage people to, if they're not going to show up at the board meeting, but to at least watch it and be apprised of, I think we're making some real progressive movements in this county. So
good.
Thanks.
Candace?
No reports.
Tamar?
No reports.
Okay. I have a couple things. Oral Health Commission, Coalition met last week, and I totally missed the meeting because I only looked at my calendar not beyond 9 o'clock, and the meeting was at 12:30. But they did introduce the new program manager, right, Dr. Bornstein? Yeah. And then also Joel Derringer was there and talked about the strategic plan that they're putting together for oral health, and I promise I will make the next meeting. Wednesday of this week is the Tobacco Control Coalition. I will go this meeting, but David was our rep on that, and David has resigned. So we do need to have somebody step up to the plate and maybe take this responsibility on. We've have a good presence and has had for some time. The meeting is at 4 o'clock, and I've forgotten. Penny, do you remember, do they meet every other month or monthly? I think it's every other month. I think it's every other month, Wednesday at 4 o'clock. I'll bring back some more information, and then I'll begin twisting arms. Okay? Healthy Communities Work Group, we meet the first Thursday of every month at 8 o'clock. I can never get there on time, but I'm there by 8:10 at least. The traffic on 227 is horrible in the morning. But this is a really active group.
That's why you have to plan transportation.
Yeah, that's good. We continue to look at plans. We are putting together some of our data, so I'll bring it back to you at some point as soon as we get it together about over the last few years, how many things we've looked at, how many things we've commented on. We are planning an event in October because it is Healthy Communities Month. It will be a public event, and we'll talk about housing, actually, and health and housing and those kinds of things. So as we get the actual date finalized, I think we'll probably do it at the Vets Hall in Inslo, so it'll be central. And certainly we will all be invited. So with that, let's do committee reports for ourselves. Well, we never have a budget. Legislative, there's not a lot going on. Nominating, it is the time of year. Claire wants to hear from you as you all can suggest people to be on our executive committee for the upcoming year. We do also have three openings on the commission. Claire will not be with us for the upcoming year, and David has currently resigned. He's having some health issues. And then we've had an opening forever. So we have two direct provider positions that we need to fill, and we have one consumer. Well, Claire.
She was a direct provider. Because she started in that role.
Yeah, she started before she retired. So we have two in our hardest positions to fill to begin with. So get out there, twist the arms of your health professionals that you know of, and see if we can't get that filled. And then the consumer position is open as well. So any suggestions for prospective future items? We will have our planning retreat in July. I think one of the things that we have talked about for a number of years and we never get at, but I think the emergency management issue is something that we always say we want to have a program at, and we never have actually done that. Maybe we can work on that a little harder and have that as one of our topics for the next year. Anybody else have anything additional this evening? If not, I believe we'll be adjourned. Thank you all for coming. Oh, I missed it.